Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, greetings one and all to another episode of the podcast. We're going to do something on this episode that ties more into current events than you would typically hear on a history podcast. Now, we like to dig into stories of the past that people have probably overlooked and make you see things in a different way. And we're going to do that by looking at the media. Now, you probably know something about how presidents engage with media in the modern era. Throughout Barack Obama's presidency, he would release NCAA tournament brackets. He would show up on Jimmy Fallon and a lot of other TV shows. And he was also the first president to use Twitter. Sometimes his staff would write a tweet, but when it was Barack Obama himself, he would sign it B-O. Well, in the early days of the Donald Trump presidency, of course, he has been using Twitter all over the place, sometimes to very good effect to sidestep traditional media gatekeeper channels. Other times, he can step on his own rhetorical toes. Well, presidents using media is not a new thing. We have a guest with us, Dr. Tevi Troy, who's written a book called What Jefferson Read, Ike Watched, and Obama Tweeted, 200 Years of Popular Culture in the White House. He talks about all sorts of things, about the literary works that shaped the political philosophy of Thomas Jefferson, why Abraham Lincoln's love of theater prompted him to ignore advice from advisors the night of his assassination, how Dwight Eisenhower loved Westerns so much that his staff struggled to keep them in supply, and how Ronald Reagan identified the unifying role of film and often used movie quotes to rouse support. Well, Dr. Tevi Troy is not just a historian. He is also somebody who's worked at high levels in U.S. politics. Right now, he is the president of the American Healthcare Policy Institute. But in 2007, he was confirmed by the U.S. Senate as the deputy secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. What that basically means is that he ran an enormous civilian department in the federal government with a budget of over $700 billion. He basically ran Medicare and Medicaid as far as I know. Well, he was a staff member in the George W. Bush administration, and at one point, many of his advisors were tasked to read a book about the Spanish flu outbreak in 1918 to deal with epidemics in the 21st century. So he has hands-on experience about how presidents consumed popular culture and even used it in order to affect policy and be successful as presidents. Now, they also messed up a lot when they use it too, especially with tone-deaf presidents like Jimmy Carter. We're going to get all into these issues in this episode, so let's jump right into the interview with Tevi Troy.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Tevi, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, we're going to talk a lot about media in this episode. So I feel like I need to ask this question to start out. Are you much of a Twitter user?
Yeah, you caught me, and my wife catches me as well. She thinks I'm on Twitter way too much. I do tweet a number of times a day, and I do kind of follow what's going on via Twitter. I find it a great source. And let me just give your listeners one tip. If you are looking at Twitter on Tuesday night, you will be reading what the headlines are in your local paper on Thursday morning. So it just gives you a jump start on the news.
Is there, wait, it's that far ahead? I would get Tuesday night to Wednesday, but a whole day and a half, huh?
The Tuesday night, things that appear Tuesday night are too late to appear in the Wednesday papers. So if there's some big development Tuesday night after, let's say, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you're not going to read about it until the Thursday paper. Huh. So I find that very helpful. I also think it's a great way to follow people you're interested in, which is in contrast to Facebook, which is people you have to have some kind of relationship with. I have a lot of friends. They're not always the best people to tell me what's going on in the news or in sports or in other things I'm interested in. So I can find people that I just happen to be interested in, even if I don't necessarily have a personal relationship with them, and listen to what they're saying and learn from it.
And for better or for worse, you get the unfiltered gut reaction from people, which could tie into our current president. And I'm sure that will come out at the end of this conversation, because I'd love to hear what you think of Trump and his tweeting. That's an interesting tie into all these topics.
Donald Trump used Twitter very effectively. He would not be president if he did not have Twitter, if Twitter had not existed. He is not original in the use of Twitter. And then Barack Obama had a Twitter account before Trump. Some of the tweets that came were personally from Obama. They would have the letters B-O at the end. And in fact, the title of my book, as you know, is What Jefferson Read, Ike Watched, and Obama Tweeted. So I would say that I am the first presidential historian to write a book about a president with the words tweet or tweet and Twitter in the title. However, I suspect now with the Trump presidency, we will have more of it.
Right.
Trump is in a slightly different situation than Obama in that the media, I believe, are unrelentingly hostile to Trump. Obama would sometimes complain about media coverage, but for the most part, he had not only a lot of supporters in the media, but you had something like 2 to 3 dozen people who worked in the media who rotated into the Obama administration. You're not really seeing that in the Trump administration. You're unlikely to see that in the Trump administration. So President Trump feels that he needs to get his message out in an unfiltered way to the people, and Twitter allows him to do that. He is not original in this thought either. There have been previous media that the presidents have used to get directly to the people. One example is the radio. Franklin Roosevelt started using radio as governor of New York State to get around the Republican-leaning media companies, specifically the newspapers in New York State. And he would go on the radio as a way to get his message directly to the people. Later, when he was president, he continued to use radio effectively via the famous fireside chats. John F. Kennedy also was effective at using TV in his 1960 campaign, and it helped him defeat Richard Nixon in that race. Not long after the race, Kennedy walked by a television with one of his aides and looked at it and said, "We wouldn't have had a prayer without that gadget." I love the fact that as late as 1960, the President Kennedy is still referring to TV as that gadget.
that idiot box or whatever they referred to it back then.
Right. So Trump is just following in a presidential tradition of using existing media and new technological platforms to get directly to the people. That said, you have to be careful when you're president about the words you use and the way in which you use them, and the tone is important. so is the content. So you, if you're president, you really have to be careful in what you say. And sometimes Twitter is not the best medium for being careful about what you say. It's just about getting your visceral responses and immediate reactions out right afterwards, as opposed to a more thoughtful response.
And he does say some things that can be considered by some to be shocking. But as you've read and as I've seen, presidents have said bombastic things and shocking things over well, I mean, the history of the United States. And I want to ask you about how you got into the idea to write this book in the beginning, especially in light of your background. I was looking up your background, and one of the first things that popped up said that you're the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which, as far as my non-government mind could understand, was it sounded like you basically ran Medicare. So that's a really interesting transition. So from your work in high levels of government to studying the history of American government, what got you onto this project?
Well, it's important to remember that studying the history of the American presidency is what came first. I did my PhD at University of Texas. I focused on presidential history. I wrote my first book on intellectuals and the White House back in 2001. So I have a long history of focusing on presidential history and what goes on in the White House. I then had the privilege to work in the White House, so that makes me one of a rare handful of people who studied the presidency in graduate school, and then also got to work in the White House at very high levels. And that gives me a perspective, I think, that is somewhat unique on the presidency itself. I did get promoted out of my White House job and end up as Deputy Secretary of Health, and I do have a lot of interest in healthcare issues and have continued to write about healthcare issues ever since. But I've retained my love of presidential history and continue to write about it. I've written two more books on presidential history, the book about presidents and pop culture, which we're discussing now, and then my subsequent one, Shall We Wake the President, on presidents and disasters. And I think that from following presidential history, we can learn so much about how presidents have dealt with the crises of the past or the media of the past, and how those lessons can be applied to what happens in the future. And that's what really brought me to the project in a general sense. In a more specific sense, I mentioned that my first book was about intellectuals and the presidency. And what I'd really wanted to write was about books that influenced the presidents. And at the time, this is pre-internet, I must confess, it was just too hard to find the material I needed to write that book. But I started looking into this question, and once I had more technological capabilities available to researchers, I could do a lot better job of figuring out what presidents read. And I wrote a piece, not a book, but a piece for the Washington Post on what presidents read. And then I followed it up with a piece for Washingtonian Magazine on movies presidents watched. I had to give a speech not long after that, and I tied the two together, and someone who was in the audience heard it and said, you know what, you should write a book tying this whole thing together. And that's what I did. That's how the book came about.
Okay. Yeah, and there's a lot to jump into, because over this 230-year period, the nature of media changes so much. So let's go back to the beginning, when we're looking at the founding fathers, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, the first three presidents. How did they engage with popular culture in their time?
Obviously, back then, things were very different in terms of technology. You didn't have all of the technological cultural platforms that you have today. If a president was interested in getting some sort of outside information or entertainment, he had two choices. He could read a book, or he could read the written word, or he could go and see live entertainment, specifically theater. It wasn't so easy to get the written word even back then. The books that were available in the colonies were rare and expensive. A first edition of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations in 1776 in the colonies cost about $600 in today's money. So it was very expensive. Think about it. You can get an iPad for the amount of money it would have cost you to buy one book back then. Hmm. And an iPad, if you think about it, can store something like 50,000 books. So there really was a technological impediment, or at least a cost impediment, to getting books. But even so, our founding fathers, such as Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, whom you mentioned, all had huge libraries. Washington, the smallest one, at about 900 books. Adams had about 3,000 books, and Jefferson, I believe, had about 6,000 books. So they spent a lot of their hard-earned money on getting books and making sure that they were well-read. And Jefferson himself had said famously, "I cannot live without books." So books were extremely important to them. They read books. They read them carefully. They marked up the margins, and they discussed them in their letters that went back and forth. As for theater, Washington was a big fan of theater, and he would go to many plays while he was president. And he even staged a play for the men of the Continental Army during that very difficult winter at Valley Forge. So he recognized the theatricality of leadership, as I call it in my book. He recognized that theater could be important unifier as giving messages, and he also dressed for his part. He always wore the appropriate coat. He looked very tall and strong in the saddle. And so I think he learned a lot from theater about how to present himself.
I read also in a Walter Isaacson biography of Benjamin Franklin that one way he got ahead in the colonies was by both being a printer to produce the written word in newspaper form, but also being a postmaster so he could control circulation and keep his competitors from being able to get messages out. Did any of the early presidents have a concept of using the press, of making statements and getting in papers and trying to influence public opinion in early America?
Oh, absolutely. The pamphlets were extremely important in shaping public opinion. There was Thomas Paine's famous work, Common Sense, that helped lay out the cause, the case for the Revolutionary War. The Declaration of Independence was obviously carefully considered and then distributed to newspapers. The Federalist Papers were, in effect, a form of propaganda, a way by Madison, Hamilton, and John Jay to make the case for the U.S. Constitution in papers across the country. And so, yeah, the Founding Fathers were very aware of the importance of media, and the media was primitive by our standards. It didn't have the same technological capabilities, but it was there, and the American colonists were not only well-read, but the literacy rate in the colonies was higher than that of in Europe. Even though Europe looked down on the colonists were actually more literate. And so getting your message out via the newspapers, which is basically what the Federalist Papers did, was an extremely important way of making an argument and getting public support behind you.
And I think – I forget which election it was. It was either 1796 or 1800 between Adams and Jefferson. It's sort of the first nasty election in American history. And people – okay, that's it. People get their upset about Hillary's basket of deplorables and things Trump has said, but – I think Adams mentioned that he was called a hermaphrodite who has neither the strength of a man nor the softness of a woman. And who was doing these hatchet jobs in the media?
Well, Jefferson had a guy named Freneau, who was his agent, who would write these nasty things in the media about Madison. So and the guy was basically Jefferson's press lackey, kind of like an early version of, I guess, a David Brock or something for Hillary in this recent election. But yeah, the press were quite nasty. And I often look at that 1800 election, even though it was nasty, I think it was perhaps the most important election in our history. Because it was a contested election. You had the sitting president, Adams, who lost to Jefferson and then voluntarily gave up power. This is something that had never happened before. Now, Washington winning an election, okay, everybody knew Washington was going to win. Adams, his sort of handpicked successor, winning, okay, well, Washington was giving up the office anyway. But Adams was someone who wanted to stay in power for another term, ran and lost, and he willingly left power. And so I think he deserved a lot of credit for that. Now, I don't want to go too far in praise of Adams because he was a bit of a bad sport. He left before the inaugural festivities. He got out of Washington because he didn't want to see it. But given that he's the first person in history to voluntarily give up power like that, I think a huge amount of credit goes to him.
Something else I thought of when I was looking into these topics before our interview about the role of press with presidents. Sometime after Adams' presidency ended, it was a long time, 10 or 15 years, when he patched things up with Jefferson and began their famous correspondence. I think he also publicly addressed in newspapers, he refuted the slanders against him when he was president. And I forget which slanders. I don't know if it was the hermaphrodite comment or something else. But that struck me as odd that he would go after charges that were 10 or 15 years in the past. It would be like if George W. Bush came out of retirement and dredged up some old criticism from 2004. We'd think, well, what's the point? That's in the past. Obviously, it made some kind of sense for Adams to do that. So what was the logic behind that?
Well, first of all, it wouldn't shock me if our current president did something along those lines, right? I mean,
right.
If somebody made some accusation about his business dealings in New York from 20 years ago, I could see him using the full power of his Twitter presidency and going after the accuser.
Good point, yeah.
So presidents, like anybody else, want to set the record straight. Some people just don't want to let things go. In terms of Adams, he was sensitive to his press criticism, and he felt that he was ill-treated. And not only was he ill-treated by the press, but by historians for a long time. It really wasn't until the McCullough biography that he started to get his due. And in many ways, he's the forgotten founder, or the founder who gets the least accolades. But he was an extremely important founder, not just because of his presidency, but because of his work on the Declaration, the Constitutional Congress, and early diplomacy. And so, obviously, I think he had a good record, and he wanted to make sure he defended it.
Okay. Makes sense. Very human, something we forget with a lot of these larger-than-life characters. So that's something that affected Adams, the role that he could see popular culture was beginning to play. Where else have you seen that popular culture has affected presidential agendas or policies?
Wow. I mean,
big question. So I guess you can take it anywhere you want.
It's a big question in that it's my entire book.
Right.
The concept of the book, of what Jefferson read, Ike watched, and Obama tweeted, is that every president has had at least some interaction with the popular culture. And to some degree, it helped shape them, because the popular culture is who makes us who we are. Let me just talk about our recently departed president, President Obama. Here is a guy who was raised on TV to a degree that no other president had ever been, or subsequent president yet. I mean, obviously, we only have one. He watched a tremendous amount of TV. He was the product of a single he had a single mom, because his dad had left shortly after he was born. His mom was absent because she was doing her work in Indonesia. And so he lived with his grandparents in Hawaii. And in the evenings, he would go to the comic book store on the way home. Then he would watch cartoons. Then he'd watch TV with his grandfather until Johnny Carson came on. Remember, that's sitting through the whole primetime schedule. And then he would listen to pop music on his FM radio until he went to bed. This is not me making this up. This is in his own memoir. He describes what his childhood was like with his grandparents in Hawaii. That is a lot of TV to be taken in. I mean, I've got four kids. I do not let them have that kind of constant pop culture ingestion, even though they watch more TV than I would like. Still, it's just not the kind of parenting that usually produces a president in the United States. So this guy is very, very well-versed in American TV and American popular culture. And I think it helped him to some degree in his connectivity with American audiences, with the American people, with the voters. He watched what they watched, and he understood what their worldview was based on his deep understanding of American popular culture.
Can you think of some examples of that in his speeches or the way that he would connect with voters?
Sure. I mean, he would make jokes and asides about Star Trek or Star Wars. In fact, he made one mistake where he talked about the Jedi mind meld, which was confusing the Vulcan mind meld and the Jedi touch or whatever. I'm not sure what Jedi action, but he confused Jedis and Vulcans in a way in one of his comments, and got a lot of criticism from the fanboys. But if you think about it, he got the criticism in part because the expectations were on him were so high. Here's a guy who grew up watching Star Trek, who said that he had a crush on Lieutenant Uhura when he was growing up, and then later Nichelle Nichols, who played her, came to the White House and he told her about this boyhood crush. Here was a guy who really knew what he was talking about when it came to popular culture because he had ingested so much of it.
I think he was trying to say Jedi mind trick, which shows you where I fall right on the nerd boy divide right there.
So he clearly was trying to say that.
Right.
But there is a there's a Vulcan mind meld.
Right.
And there's a Jedi mind trick. So they're two different things. And he conflated the two.
Right. So this is something that is, as you've written about, different from presidents in the past. So can you think of what are some other examples? We have the founders we've looked at with the age of pamphlets, and then we're in the digital age. In that great divide between, what are other examples like that that stick out in your mind?
Well, sure. I love to talk about Abraham Lincoln and his obsession with reading. If you read any Lincoln biography, there's almost this obligatory passage with the desperation Lincoln had to get books. And it was in some ways harder for him to get books on his farm in Indiana and his growing up in Indiana and Kentucky than it was for people like Adams and Jefferson, who was just it was a financial cost, but they were able to access them. So Lincoln would walk many miles to find a book to borrow. When he couldn't borrow books, he read the same books that he had over and over again. Those books included the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress, and a biography of Washington. And those books that he read so often, Aesop's Fables was another one of them, he had them almost memorized and used them effectively in his career. And he used their methods also. So when I say that he understood biblical language, think of 70 years is an allusion to biblical language. In the Aesop's Fables, taught him how to use a story to make a point. Pilgrim's Progress talked him about Christian imagery. The Washington book taught him about patriotism. And so he used the concepts he learned from these books, some of which he read over and over again, to make himself into the great president that he became. And given that he was a poor kid from a farm whose mother died, who was really a nobody from nowhere, he made himself who he was by virtue of his reading.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He's fascinating. I read a book recently called Lincoln's Melancholy, and I think it said that when he would take long trips on horseback in southern Illinois, he read Euclid's Geometry or some logic book by Euclid, and it helped him to develop a logical mind as a lawyer. And that's amazing that he would obsess over something that I think a lot of people would have difficulty going through.
Yeah, he clearly had a very nimble mind. And he realized at an early age how he needed to nourish that mind. And he was a very literate person. He made a lot of literary references in his speeches, especially Shakespeare. He loved Shakespeare. He loved the theater. He didn't see much of it growing up, but once he became president, he often went to the theater. Obviously, we know that he died attending the theater, but there was a previous assassination attempt. John Wilkes Booth wanted to kill him on his way to see a play up at the Old Soldiers Home up 16th Street in Washington, and that attempt was aborted. So Lincoln's love of the theater was very well known to everybody, including those who wanted to do him ill.
He sounds a lot like Reagan when you mention that, someone who uses the theater as a way to be a better politician.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, Reagan, obviously movies were much more important in the American consciousness than theater by the time Reagan became president. But Reagan made movie references all the time. And he, there almost seemed to be a symbiotic relationship with the go-go movies of the 80s and the very, there's sort of a muscular style to 1980s movies, but also an exuberant style. Think of movies like Rambo, showed kind of American power, but also Back to the Future showed the love of American technology and a kind of an optimistic spirit that you can fix things. So Reagan really fit in with the style of movies in the 80s, and he would cite those movies and make references to them.
Right. I think one of my earliest memories of him was him saying, maybe I'm not remembering this, but it's me having a false memory, but his Back to the Future comment of where we're going, we don't need roads. I guess that'd be 85 Back to the Future. Maybe it's possible,
right?
But memories, not always trustworthy.
But I think there's also a time when he saw Rambo, and it was right after there had been an Islamic radical terrorist hijacking of a TWA jet, and he said something like, "I just saw Rambo, and now I know what to do next time this happens." So he really did know how to make these comments about what was going on in the popular culture and relate it to the political world.
So who would you say amongst presidents are the best and worst at using popular culture? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people tried to do things like what Reagan would do, where, love him or hate him, he obviously was a charismatic person who had a good EQ, but many of our presidents did not, and their attempts to be relatable can be less than successful. So who do you think were some of the best and worst presidents at using pop culture?
So let me take two Democratic presidents and give one high marks and one low marks. On the high mark side, you have to give Bill Clinton, who really had a very good sense of American popular culture, saw a lot of movies, could talk movies very well. In fact, at one point, people said that he could be a movie critic. He knew movies so well. And he just had a good sense of what was going on in American popular culture. He also, at the same time, had the highbrow side of him, because he read a lot of policy books, and people were always amazed at how much he read at the same time that he was also watching so much. And one of the reasons that you may find amusing is that he really didn't sleep that much. He slept something like 3 to 4 hours a night, and he would be up late into the night either reading or watching movies or talking to aides, and he was constantly on the go. A president who I think was not so effective was with Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter saw something like 450 movies in his single term in the White House. And I calculated that's about 2 movies a week over the course of an entire presidency. And remember, he only had one term. But he had no ability to relate the movies he was seeing to any larger purpose or to the American people. And there was even one back and forth on the campaign trail about the movie The Deer Hunter. And Carter clearly didn't get the point of the movie in a way that Ronald Reagan also referred to the movie in a way he did. So it's great to take in popular culture in appropriate doses. But if you're president, you can't just passively watch the movies. You have to find some way to connect it to the voters, to yourselves, to your larger agenda.
Yeah. Speaking of presidents who didn't have the most charming personality, could you tell me about Nixon and the hurricane story?
Right. Well, Nixon and the hurricane story, this is getting to my book about Shall We Wake the President, about presidents and disasters. There's a long, development of this concept of presidents getting more and more involved in disasters. For most of the 19th century, they weren't involved at all. And then there was increasing involvement through different levels of the administration. By the time that Nixon comes around and Hurricane Camille strikes in 1969, he sends his vice president, Spiro Agnew, to the Gulf region to report back on what's going on. And when Nixon has a meeting with Agnew after the visit, he asks him what he learned and what he can tell, what Agnew could tell the president about what's going on down there. And Agnew reported that some of the people complained to him that they really couldn't calibrate the severity of the hurricane. So they just didn't know whether to shelter in place or evacuate or do nothing. They knew a hurricane was coming, but they just didn't know how bad it was going to be. And so Nixon directs the federal bureaucracy to look into this problem to see if they can come up with a solution. And the solution that they come up with is this concept of the five-category system for hurricanes that we have today, category 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 storm. That comes directly out of this experience that Nixon had with the Hurricane Camille experience in 1969.
Okay. And so he was trying to figure out how to best address this thing. And because there could be, if you're forcing people to run and scurry away from something that's nothing, it's a misappropriation of funds. If you do nothing and it's a terrible disaster, then you're asleep at the switch. That type of dynamic, if I understand it
correctly. Basically right. People need to know how to act when a hurricane's coming. And look, we had this bit in Katrina, New Orleans, when we knew the hurricane was going to be severe. People were told to evacuate. They even had the buses in New Orleans, and then the mayor never followed through and actually effectuated that evacuation, which would have been necessary.
So different presidents would use literature, like you said, Lincoln understanding Shakespeare, or scripture using the Bible. More modern presidents would refer to Star Wars, Star Trek, and movies. But what do you think is the pop culture event that has had the most profound influence on the presidency throughout American history?
Wow, that's a really good and serious question. One thing I will point to, and I'm not sure I'm going to be willing to say it's the most, but one influential moment was when Woodrow Wilson screened Birth of a Nation in the White House in 1916 or so. This is the first movie screened in the White House, and it was screened in the White House in part because Wilson's wife had died and he was still in mourning and didn't want to leave the White House. So that's how the tradition of having movies screened in the White House actually began. And the person who had written the book on which it was based is someone who had gone to Princeton with Wilson, so he was willing to do the favor of having presidential attention paid to this movie. But the movie, as you know, is this racist movie that depicts the Confederates as the correct ones in history, and the freed blacks and Union soldiers after the Civil War as the evil aggressors. And the rumor is, or at least the story through history, is that Wilson said that this was history written by lightning, which isn't necessarily an endorsement of the film or the film's message so much as an endorsement of the medium and how powerful it is. But there were protests about that, and this idea has gone down through history that Wilson was a fan of this basically racist film. I think this is incredibly important, A, because it showed that the presidents really need to be careful what they say about movies, and you can't be even seeming to endorse a movie that has a highly inappropriate message, certainly not a racist message. But second, it starts this tradition of movies being screened in the White House, which has a many-year tradition that's even ongoing. I read that the first movie that President Trump showed in the White House was Finding Dory,
right? I heard
which
about
he
that.
Showed to his staff and some aides. And apparently Trump was there at the beginning and then left, and he didn't actually sit through the movie. But you know, he's president. He's got a lot of stuff to do.
Do you know what the effect was after Wilson showed Birth of a Nation? Did that somehow give it an endorsement that gave it more legs than it would have had otherwise? Or
yeah, the movie was incredibly successful from a financial standpoint. And you have to think that Wilson's apparent endorsement had some positive impact. I knew if President Trump said, "I like this movie today," and you know, may not have such a huge impact, but just because we're used to it. But back then, to have the president endorse a movie would have been a big deal. That said, there is an ongoing phenomenon of what I call the presidential book bump. That when a president is seen reading a book or discusses a book, that book often does spike on the bestseller lists. You had John F. Kennedy said that he liked the John le Carré novels, the James Bond novels that were written by Ian Fleming, and that helped the sales of those books. Bill Clinton was a big mystery reader, and sometimes he would endorse certain mysteries in like a Walter Mosley book, and then those would have bumps. And then Ronald Reagan may have made the career of Tom Clancy by talking about how he was reading Hunt for Red October, and then the book shortly after that became a bestseller.
Right. And I think I know Obama has regularly released his reading lists, as you have mentioned, perhaps using pop culture to his own advantage. And I think Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Team of Rivals, the Lincoln book, it may have been popular before he mentioned it, but I'm sure it boosted it. And then he invited her to the White House for his, I guess, the first draft of his memoir. So it has this recursive effect.
Right. So, and I talk about the Doris Kearns Goodwin book in my book, because not only did Obama endorse it and appear to be taking his transition guidance from it, but also it's something that Bush had read previously and appeared to. So that book got a double presidential book bump. As for Bush, it's important to remember that he was a huge reader. People give him short shrift, I think, but he would read 60 to 90 serious books a year. He had a reading contest with Karl Rove every year. He really liked biography and history, and reading really helped inform his thinking. He read this book called The Great Influenza about the 1918 flu, and that spurred him to request his staff, including myself, who was working there at the time, to develop a flu plan so that if there were a massive viral outbreak in the U.S. would be ready and do a better job than they did in the 1918 flu, when 675,000 Americans died from that Spanish flu. And it reduced the average life expectancy of the U.S. by a decade.
Huh. So I have to ask, since you had a front row seat to history here, what was the takeaway when the whole staff read this book? You know, this is from 1918, so it's a different point in history. But did you all think, well, I think this is the lesson we need to apply as we consider handling epidemics in the 21st century?
There was a recognition that, obviously, we felt Wilson, and if you read the book, it's pretty clear. And it's also in my book and show, Wait the President, I talk about this episode. But Wilson had fallen down on the job. He did not do a good job. Maybe he was helpful to Birth of a Nation, but he was not helpful to the nation in that 1918 flu. And we recognized that we had a different series of tools, right? The development of flu vaccines, for example, antivirals, modern communications, all these things were helpful. Also, science about the spread of disease and how to mitigate the spread of disease. So given these new tools, how could we develop a flu plan that could protect the nation in case of a flu outbreak? And we built our models around avian flu, in case an avian flu broke out. It ended up that the next problematic flu that broke out was actually a swine flu. It broke out in the Obama administration early on, 3 months in, before any of his top people were confirmed at HHS. But the Obama people used that flu plan that we developed in the Bush administration, and they used it effectively. And in fact, in the year of the swine flu in 2009, there were fewer flu deaths than in the average year. So breaking out the stockpile, accelerating the development of antivirals, using countermeasures really helped limit the deaths in that year.
Okay, I have to say this gets me pretty excited as someone who studied history that, yes, it is useful to know facts from a very different era, and it can apply to today. So you can even develop policy around something like this. Were there ever any other things like that during your time when you were working in the Bush administration pulling these historical lessons?
One example I think of immediately is when we were trying to develop a health IT infrastructure. Secretary Leavitt, for whom I worked at HHS, would read the Stephen Ambrose book about the development of the railroads and how we found that when the railroads were at different gauge levels that you couldn't connect them. And so if you didn't have some body governing the architecture of the railroads, you could have a nationwide railroad system that actually wouldn't work. And so it helped his thinking on interoperability. Another example is President Bush read Natan Sharansky's book on democracy and what a great system it is before his second inaugural, and he gave it out to his top staff to read, and that ended up being the theme of his second inaugural address about the promotion of democracy nationwide, and may have led to the Arab Spring, which was not as successful as we lovers of freedom and democracy would like, but it certainly did affect things around the world.
That's an interesting tie-in. This moves outside the purview of the United States, but I was at a Middle Eastern Studies conference at when the Arab Spring was happening, and everybody, of course, was, you know, talking in glowing terms that these old guard nationalist dictators, these Baathists, were being thrown out of power, and it was this People's Liberation Movement. And as we see after the fact, it has not been positive. Is there anything different in America from what you see about how leaders and presidents use social media effectively or ineffectively versus people in other countries?
Yeah, so I really found an insight in this in my first book about presidents and intellectuals, where I realized that American presidents need intellectuals in a way that leaders in other countries don't, because the party structure determines who is in charge in the other countries, and we have a weaker party system here. So the way you get to become the British Prime Minister is you win an election of the British MPs. I mean, it's the parliamentary system, and then those people effectively make you. It would be like the House of Representatives voting who their favorite is, and then that person, should the Republicans win the election, becomes the president. Our system is different, and you have much more independent actors going after the nomination among grassroots people. And we saw this year with Donald Trump, where he clearly was not the party favorite, but he picked themes that appealed to the American people. And so the idea is that use of messaging, of intellectuals, of outside groups, of popular culture can help you in your – it's really effectively a guerrilla campaign, because you're not – nobody – Hillary Clinton, I guess, was sort of endorsed by the Democratic Party and had the Democratic Party apparatus. But even there, the DNC had to deny that they were helping her. But for most nominees, or most attempted nominees, are trying – most candidates for the nomination are out there on their own fighting a guerrilla war, living off the land. And they use media, they use pop culture, they use social media to their advantage as best they can to try and win that nomination. And only once they win that nomination do they then take over the party apparatus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So you're saying that the importance of intellectuals is to ground these people who use a more populist system to gain power, whereas in a parliamentary system, they're already having to work through elite channels to gain power. So that's why this is important in America. Do I understand that correctly?
Slightly. I mean, what I'm really saying is that intellectuals, certainly in the Republican Party, have an important signaling effect, and they tell you where this certain candidate stands. Now, Donald Trump took a different approach, and he rejected the mainstream conservative intellectuals and said, those guys don't speak for you. Those don't speak for the average person. But you use different tools, and different times different tools are more effective, but you use different tools to get your message out. And they can be in the popular culture. They can be using think tank scholars or well-known intellectuals to signal, hey, this guy's behind me. So George W. Bush in 2000 did a very good job of winning over the scholars from the Hoover Institution and the American Enterprise Institute. In 2012, I'd say Mitt Romney had that group kind of cornered. In 2016, it was a more diffuse candidate pool, and nobody really had the intellectuals cornered. I mean, there was a boomlet for Scott Walker, I would say, and after Walker dropped out pretty early, I think some of them went to Bush and some went to Rubio. But given that they were that they were all spread out and they didn't really unify behind a single candidate, that gave a guerrilla candidate like Donald Trump an ability to consolidate the people who really didn't feel that the intellectuals were speaking for them.
This is definitely a reconfiguration of American politics.
Absolutely.
I want to switch gears a little bit and ask about if presidents have tried to exaggerate their involvement with popular culture to develop a certain appearance. You mentioned Jimmy Carter incorrectly using those references to Deer Hunter and other films. Can you think of any other examples of presidents who've done this?
Well, I mean, there's the famous story of Ronald Reagan supposedly talking about the Star Wars program based on his understanding of the best Bancroft movies of the 1940s, the kind of death ray that can destroy projectiles in the sky. I'm not sure that's a perfect example of what you're talking about. I also mentioned Obama. So Obama was trying to show that he was a fan of the White Sox growing up, and he was asked about them, and he said that they played in Comiskey Park, which obviously is not the name of the place they play. It's at Comiskey Park without the N. And then he was asked to name his favorite White Sox player growing up, and he couldn't name a single player. So sometimes you got presidents who seem to be fans of something, and then they really can't prove that they are. So that's why you have to be careful. I always say that authenticity is the most important thing. Obama had all those pop stars coming out for him, and I think it worked because people might believe that he was listening to Jay-Z or Beyonce. But when Hillary had all those pop stars coming out for Katy Perry and the like, nobody really believed that Hillary sat around listening to Katy Perry music.
And if she did, then that's even more troubling. I remember in the Iowa caucus in 2008 when at one point Obama mentioned about the price index and asking, have you seen the price of arugula recently at Whole Foods? Which for me as a native Iowan, I can promise you doesn't exist, nor would anyone know what arugula is. So it's tricky being in a lot of different geographies. So to kind of tie in all these things that we've mentioned, how much it's changed over history from the founding fathers to today, and Barack Obama being one of the first presidents to use Twitter, and for Donald Trump, I mean, that's a hallmark of how he communicates. So to tie in these things, let's focus on Donald Trump, but you can mention Obama as well. Do you think his embrace of social media is helpful or detrimental to the office of the president?
Yeah, well, so when you said helpful and detrimental, and then you said to the office of the president. So those are two different things. Right. Clearly, I think Twitter has been helpful to him in allowing him to distinguish himself among a crowded field of Republican candidates and in helping get his message out against a largely hostile media, and could potentially be helpful to him going forward. I do worry about it being problematic for the gravitas of the office and the stature of the office. I also worried about Obama's constant use of pop culture going on comedic shows and joking around with Zach Galifianakis. So I think it's an ongoing problem of presidents in some ways diminishing the stature of the office while at the same time doing things that they need to do in order to remain popular and going directly to the American people. So I think these, like any other tools, they're useful tools if wielded correctly.
So to wrap this up, I have to ask you, because you have been at high level of politics, and I'd say you'd be qualified to answer. If a president asked you, if Donald Trump asked you, how do I best use the media to not, you know, lower the dignity of the office, but also maintain this connection to the public and get around sometimes the media filter if it's not all that accommodating to me, what would you say? Like, how would you outline the best media strategy based on all the things that you've studied?
I think first you'd have to compliment him and say he's very effective at getting his message out directly via Twitter and what an effective tool it is. But say that you need to take a slightly more presidential tone in your messages. That does not mean you give up being who you are, but think about the messages a little bit more. And I got to say, I don't read every one of his tweets, but enough of them are covered in the papers that I get the sense that they have toned down a little bit since he's become president, or at least since his first few days in office. And I think you'll have to look over time, maybe compare his tweets pre-campaign to post-campaign to post-White House, and in order to make a real accurate assessment. But I think tone is really the key thing, because you don't want to tell the president of the United States, who obviously used Twitter effectively to get where he is, give up that tool that is the only tool that lets you get your message out without the New York Times filtering it for you in a way that is negative to you. So you have to be very careful to advise a president on something that is realistic.
Good advice. Well, Tevi, thank you so much for all this information. And also I have to say that your book, What Jefferson Read, Ike Watch, and Obama Tweeted, it's enjoyable to read, but very profound. It's profound in its simplicity, which isn't easy to pull off in a book. So Really good read. And if people want to find out more about what you've read or what you've written and your background, where can they find you online?
You can go to my website, tevitroy.org, tevitroy.org. And that has all of my hundreds of articles that I've written and links to my books. But you can also follow me at Twitter. We've talked a lot about Twitter on this conversation. I don't have as many followers as Donald Trump, but I'm always happy to have new ones. So my Twitter handle is at TevitroY, at TevitroY, and look forward to having you follow me.
Great. And I'll put the link to your book and your website and everything else, the show notes on historyonthenet.com. Tevi, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
That was the interview with Tevitroy. Again, if you want to find all of the information and resources that we mentioned in this episode, you can go to historyonthenet.com/podcast. And if you search for Tevitroy, you'll find all the links, all the show notes, and everything else. Well, I appreciate your listening. And also go to History on the Net, and you can find contact forms if you ever have suggestions for us or questions for us in order to improve the podcast. You want to have somebody on? You want us to cover a topic we haven't covered yet? Please hit us up and we will be glad to take it into consideration. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is organized crime and punishment. History and crime like you've never heard it. Joy and Mustache Chris, Steve, and their crew as they take deep dives into the fascinating stories of the Mafia. Find organized crime and punishment at the website organizedcrimeandpunishment.com. And everywhere else you find great podcasts. Make sure you tell your friends about organized crime and punishment so that friends of yours can become friends of ours. Forget about it.